Welcome, everyone, to the First Name Basis podcast. I'm your host, Sheetal Jaitley from Tribal Scale. This is where we chat with innovators and disruptors, Tribal Scale employees, and our network from all around the world. With me today, I got a very, very special guest. I have Dinesh here, who's a serial entrepreneur. He's been the CEO, investor. He's been the founder of Hatch Labs. He co-founded Tinder for all you single people out there, so you can thank him for that. He's actually founded many companies, invested in many companies. Dinesh, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks. It's nice to be here.
Dinesh, you and I were chatting just a little while ago, and one of the things I love to talk about on this podcast is the leaders that we're learning from on this podcast all have a distinct journey. What was your journey, and how did you end up where you are?
Well, it starts early in my childhood with the defining moments that sort of shaped who I was, my outlook on life and what I wanted to accomplish. But early on, I had a loving family, but we lived in a fairly modest home. There were a few defining moments. One is I had a traumatic incident happen in high school that changed my outlook on the importance of caring for people and considering how they feel. And I won't go into that incident, but I will tell you that coming from that modest home, I had a financial grant to attend Northwestern. I couldn't have gone to Northwestern University to become a chemical engineer had I not had those experiences happen and had the financial support of a university. So it became an important factor and reminded me to give back to communities because someone gave to Northwestern, which led to my ability to afford to go to school. And so having two concurrent work study jobs in school and having the financial support of the university to go become an engineer and pursue the journey that I went on was an instrumental part in setting me on a trajectory to go work with the most amazing people I've had the opportunity to work with and also taking a path that perhaps is less traveled.
That's awesome. We talk a lot about the path is never linear and it goes about different places. So let's chat a little bit about that.
When I was graduating from HBS, I had a few opportunities in early 2003 to work in strategy consulting and in banking at Goldman and to work in technology in the US. And instead I chose to go work in Seoul, Korea at the Chairman's Group at Samsung Corporation. And I had to learn Korean to go do that.
And what did your parents say to that? I'm sure your parents were kind of like my parents when I started Tribal Scale about like, what are you doing? Why would you do this?
Yeah, they thought I was crazy.
Yeah.
My parents are very supportive and, very progressive, supportive parents. They're very loving and they know that I'm thoughtful about my decision making. But they were surprised, what benefit would I get from living in Korea? And the reality was that I learned to understand how, an entirely different culture operates in a business environment, how they make decisions, how things that we take for granted in the West are so different there. Just in my company, the term integrity means something very different in that context. It meant something a little bit more akin to loyalty than it meant to what we would define integrity here. I had a great professional experience and learned a lot, but the distinction between cultural decision-making there versus in the US was so different. But I was fortunate that Samsung was good to me and I had a lot of interesting projects where I got to learn a ton. So all these little decisions throughout my career, that's one where I've actually worked at a big company, has shaped how I've handled the adversity and challenges sort of later in my career.
This is the one common thing I think most people say is that they put themselves into very uncomfortable situations, right? I think, I did a podcast with Farhan, who you know really well, Farhan Thauer, and Farhan was saying the same thing, like, hey, if you've been let go during this pandemic and it's no fault of your own, why don't you go and try to find the opportunity where that's going to give you the best opportunity to learn? And, definitely the monetary aspect of that comes down the road afterwards because you're willing to go into these fragile situations that just necessarily aren't the linear way of moving your career.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. It's that nonlinear journey from point A to B where you learn things that you didn't expect to learn that would have been on a conventional path. that I think changes your perspective. It widens the lens that you look through, and your aperture at some point becomes so wide that these things build on each other and help shape your perspective. You know, when I was very young and I decided to be a chemical engineer at Northwestern, at the time it was the hardest thing you could do. I didn't know what being a chemical engineer was. I had some idea of what I wanted to do, but I knew at that point that if it was the hardest thing I could do, at least I would challenge myself to try to be better. And creating those sort of challenges, whether they're conscious or unconscious, I think grows you as an individual, personally and professionally. And then as you face adversity later in life, including what's going on with COVID, it just puts you in a position to say, well, look, I've dealt with worse before. I've been in a difficult situation before. I've, you know, whether you earned an engineering degree while having two concurrent work study jobs, or you had a difficult health problem in the family, whatever it is, you know that you can tackle it. So I think it's one of the most underemphasized skills to develop, which is dealing with adversity when you're younger, because everything becomes easier when you're older.
Cool. And then, so we met when you were at IIC. So how did you end up at IIC? And then let's talk a little bit about the magic that was Hatch Labs and what happened there.
Sure. So I was at Samsung in North America when I began planning my resignation. I had an idea for a local directory business, similar to what Yelp was. Yelp was only in San Francisco at the time. I believe it was around 2006. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to start a business, and the pillars of that business were really around better social, better international syndication of the content, and mobility. Now, keep in mind, the iPhone had not come out.
You were on a BlackBerry back then. If you're lucky, you're on a BlackBerry back then, or you're on a WAP site on your flip phone.
That's exactly right. So that context is important, because this was about a year ahead of the iPhone. The summer of 2007 is when the iPhone came out. I think it was in July, if I recall correctly. So I was going to start this business, had a co-founder in mind, already had some financial commitments from some early investors who had made money off one of our previous companies that I'd built. And so decided that I was going to leave Samsung to do this. And just coincidentally, I got a call from a gentleman named Matt, who was the head of recruiting at IAC. He might've been head of HR, I can't recall, but he used to be the head of career services at Harvard Business School. And so I guess he remembered me. He reached out and he said, "Are you interested in this opportunity?" That's a little company on the West Coast called CitySearch.com. And at the time, CitySearch is what Yelp is today. Mm-hmm. And I said, "That's really interesting that you say that. That's exactly the type of business, at least in concept, that I'm starting. Although I think these are the things they're doing not as well as they could. And here are the pillars of what I'm going to do." He said, "Well, would you want to interview for a head of strategy and M&A position?" And by the way, CitySearch was owned by IAC. And I said, "Well, listen, I'm going to start a business in this space. And you know, I wouldn't want to start something competitive if I've now spent time with CitySearch." And they said, "Well, what's the worst that can happen? You learn a lot." And I said, "Fair enough." So I went out and got to meet the team. Actually really liked the team, very impressive. It underscored how little I knew about the space. Sure. So when you're on the outside and you're trying to disrupt something, sometimes you just don't have the domain knowledge. So I realized how little I knew, decided I better learn as much as I could. And ended up joining the team as the VP of strategy and M&A, and worked on a number of acquisitions and helping to evolve their strategy. But it was really a function of learning from my peers, because they were so good that it was just a process of being a sponge and learning how to be an effective leader in that organization, also learning about the space. And so within 6 months, I was on the verge of resigning again, and someone senior on our team named Peter Horan, who is the CEO of Search and Media at IAC, said, "Hey, listen, I know you want to focus on mobility. Would you be willing to do something here?" And eventually we conceived of this mobile group. And I started the mobile group at IAC in June 2007, about a month before.
So that's still pre-App Store.
Correct. Yeah. We were fortunate with our timing.
For sure. For sure. And then so you started this mobile group, and like, what was the thesis? Like, how do you go build out a mobility business in a larger company like IAC?
Well, the starting point for everything is, I don't know. I didn't know how we were going to do this. I knew what my thesis was for a new mobile local directory with better content that made people's lives easier when they made decisions about where they were going to action their decisions related to what restaurant they would visit or what dry cleaner or what plumber they were going to find, et cetera, a local directory business, but because I felt it was broken. In this case, IAC had a fairly broad portfolio of interesting companies, and nobody knew what mobile was, especially back then when, as you pointed out, they were websites and a BlackBerry, and there was no iPhone. So we started step by step, from starting with I don't know to saying what content that's being produced and what is being sold could be sold through a mobile phone. Sure. It could be built for the wireless generation. And part of that was shaped by Apple, because within a month of starting this group and building out our core SMS services and our core mobile web services, the iPhone came out and it was a revolution. And I don't know if it's easy to say that now, but if you look back then, I don't think it was as clear. There were just a few thousand apps in the App Store shortly after the App Store was introduced, after the iPhone was introduced. I think they were.
I remember going back and jailbreaking my first iPhone. I think it was like a 3G iPhone. And don't jailbreak your iPhones. I was just messing around. But it was, it wasn't even like a directory I had to go through. There was like a couple hundred apps that I could go through and be like, I wonder what this one's like. Well, I wonder what that one's like. And just started messing around with a whole bunch of apps on there. Nothing like what it is today, where it's just, you know, millions of apps that are out there.
Yeah, it was the early days. Signal to noise ratio was really high. So if you put an app out there for the install base of devices that you had, you could get your audience to essentially acquire or download your products. You could acquire a user pretty quickly. And so the dynamics of App Store acquisition and getting an app installed on someone's phone, which is sitting with them 24/7 on their device in their pocket, is so radically different than it is today with so much noise. And so the acquisition strategy and marketing of companies has radically changed. But back then, it was early. It was sort of the gold rush in early days. I think I wrote a blog called The Gold Rush of mobile apps. And fortunately, that worked out pretty well. We built a number of businesses in mobility on top of the companies in the IAC portfolio. But then I decided I wanted to build my own companies.
Right. And so talk to us a little bit about Hatch, like, and the thesis behind it. And obviously, you know, many of our listeners, not me, but many of our listeners are obviously using Tinder often, and it's changed the way people date and the way people connect with each other. Talk to us a little bit about the magic that was Hatch Labs and how that happened.
Sure. In late 2009, we'd built out all of our mobile businesses that were at scale at IAC. And I realized that I wanted to do something else. So in early 2010, I told Barry Diller, I was sitting in his office on his couch. He was the chairman and CEO of IAC at the time, that I was gonna resign and work on something new. And he asked me what that was. I said, well, I'm gonna build a lab to essentially build or incubate my own early stage mobile disruptive technology companies focused on solving specific problems out in the market for the wireless generation. And he said, well, why don't you do it here? I said, well, I'm not sure that's a good idea. You know, we're a public company, our governance model, our operating model, our incentives are gonna be designed in a certain way, which is not necessarily gonna be congruent with building an early stage lab. And to Barry's credit, he held on to that idea, said, well, give it some thought and let's consider how we could structure it so you could address those things. I'm not sure he fully remembers the conversation. It's imprinted in my mind.
The one thing we got to give Barry credit for, he's always been like thinking 5-10 steps ahead of everyone else as to where the puck is moving.
Yeah, he's incredible. I think, frankly, one of the smartest business leaders I've ever met. He's visionary and he can distill really complex ideas into something fairly simple. So you got to give him credit for what he's accomplished over his career. He's incredibly unique among a very small peer set of incredible leaders in the business community.
For sure. So
that was the day before we had our quarterly annual meetings that we have with Barry. All of our CEOs were all together updating the businesses, sharing ideas. And in those meetings quarterly, Jack Welch attends. He's not a board member. He's an advisor to Barry. I didn't actually quite understand the relationship, but
it's kind of amazing though. It's just like, Hey, yeah. I'm gonna be presenting not only to Barry Diller, but by the way, Jack Welch will be sitting there too.
Right. He was there at every quarterly meeting I was ever at.
That's
during
awesome.
Our executive meetings, and he's, you know, he was brilliant, really thoughtful, incredibly sharp, and he put me on the spot in the meeting the next day and said, "You're going to start this lab thing, right?" And I didn't even know Barry spoke to him about it because I hadn't told anyone else yet, at least not at IAC, just to the investors on the outside. And I said, "Well, I'm giving it some thought." And he said, "You should do it." But he doesn't know what it is, or at least that's my interpretation, because it was too vague in the conversation with Barry for anyone to have really put a straw man together of what this could be. Anyway, it took 5 months to negotiate the terms. IAC ended up becoming an investor in this new entity called Mobile Hatch, which we, the DBA was Hatch Labs. Mm-hmm. And on October 21st, 2010, I started a new company, a Delaware C, Hatch Labs. IAC was an investor, Extreme Labs, which was doing some work with me across the IAC portfolio, that had both an investment arm as well as a separate mobile development business. Extreme Labs invested in Hatch Labs as well. And they became a minority investor. And I was off to the races to recruit and build the next generation of companies.
Right. And so how did you start figuring out which companies were there? I remember walking in your office in New York and just seeing these little pods of companies that were outside of your office, just like working on cool different ideas. Like how did the process go that these are going to be the bets we want to place? These are going to be the founders we want to place bets on. If you could talk to us a little bit about that process, because a lot of the corporations that we speak to today want to become the next IAC and say, we're going to start our own lab and we're going to create our own products and we're going to spin out these companies. So they would all love to learn from you on how you did it so successfully.
Well, I'd say first, I get approached fairly often about from large, you know, Fortune 50 companies about, hey, let's start a lab to build our own ventures. We capture the most of the value so that it becomes an owned and operated company. And it is our way of addressing, you know, Clay Christensen's innovator's dilemma. But I think that there's a few things that are often missed. I talked about governance, operating model, and incentives that, you know, a large public company might get those wrong. IAC was progressive enough to invest in this new company and recognize that they had to be open-minded about how that that was done. And so I'd say that at a high level, those were the three things that were different about making this work. And they stem from a few simple things. One, on governance, we had a separate board. I was on the board. We brought Extreme onto the board, et cetera. And what we did was we really ran it like a separate company because we didn't want the undue influence of a large public company on what we were working on. And I can tell you, they didn't influence what we were working on. We came up with our ideas independently. We recruited independently and we built our businesses independently. And so that was the first key to success. The second on the operating model, the operating model is so built on the operating manifesto and the values of the leader. And so our operating manifesto accounted for various things that were important to me as a leader for how we run the culture of our business. And that's Hatch Labs as well as the individual businesses. You know, we had concepts of Kaizen. That was one of our operating manifesto key mantras. You know, the idea of always getting better, continuous improvement. Another one was that individual relationships transcend institutions. And what we're saying is that over the career arc of working with different people, you're gonna leave companies, join companies, start your own organizations, work at nonprofits, do lots of different things. And it's these individual relationships, it's the friendships, it's the connections to help each other over that career arc that become important. And so individual relationships transcend institutions. So we had a number of these. Obviously, we focused on integrity and helping one another, but that really constituted our operating manifesto.
So this at the core, it's still your people are your most important asset.
That's exactly right.
And the networks they're able to bring and the relationships they're able to bring, it's still very people oriented.
That's right. So you have three assets. You have people, time, and money. Time and money are fixed. You can go out and get more money, but it's effectively fixed once you've raised money. People are the source of elastic value of innovation to unlock creativity and do things. So if you have people, time, and money, focus on your people. That's what really matters most. You know, I describe this journey that would normally be linear from moving from point A to B and building a company. And think of it as a rocket that has insufficient fuel to get from point A to point B. That's a conventional way of approaching things. Entrepreneurship is hacking the rocket so you can get to point B with insufficient fuel. Because if entrepreneurship was easy, you would have the resources, i.e. the fuel, to get to point B, or maybe then some. Right. But the reality is you don't. And so I think of entrepreneurship and what we were doing at Hatch, especially as a blank piece of paper. And I draw a dot of A on the piece of paper, and I draw a dot of B on the paper. And I know I can only get halfway across with the resources we have, because we're trying to build a disruption in companies that large companies have big pieces of paper with all the lines they want to get across the paper.
Right.
So I take that paper and I fold it in half and I join points A and B. That's bending space. That's hacking a solution to come up with clever ways to reach your goals with insufficient resources. And it's just an analogy, but the point is that entrepreneurs have to be very resourceful. And that's the foundation of the people that guided the principles in our operating manifesto. And then the other thing I'd say on our operations that was distinct is our value system. Our value system was very simple: share everything, do your best, and root for others. And that stemmed from my childhood, having a lot of difficulties and hardships and having empathy for other people. It's incredibly important, probably one of the most underrated attributes or characteristics that leaders today should have. Ernie Wilson's third space thinking, a well-known professor and former dean of Annenberg at USC, talks about third space thinking. He came up with it. And empathy is one of the key dimensions here. And so our value system was really driven by empathy. And then the last area is incentives. We had a pretty clever economic incentive model to keep everyone collaborating, but also focus on their ventures. And those are sort of three of the big ingredients of success to drive Tinder. But if you guys want to read about this, there's a Harvard Business School case on Tinder where they outlined our founding story and some of the decisions I took early on.
I love the aspect of this team building and this empathetic pace, because even, I remember sitting with Karthik and Nina in the corner talking to them. They were working on Blue Trumpet at the time, and I remember sitting there talking to them, but it was very collaborative. I mean, these were all separate teams on separate missions, but they were all helping each other. Whatever task at hand it wasn't like, hey, I'm in my swim lane, I'm just going to stay in that lane. I think the more and more corporate innovation labs I'm seeing, I end up walking into, are essentially taking the corporate mantra of what the big business does and then going into this beautiful office with like a ping pong table and saying, now create innovation. And there's that out of the box type of thinking and mentality is very different. I guess it's not really focused on the people, because another thing that you said is everybody, I guess, had to interview and get into the lab, as opposed to just saying, oh, well, you already work with us. Here's something cool you can go into.
Yeah. We used to screen in a few different ways. One is we'd have a particular thesis for an idea that we wanted to build. It was essentially a business concept. And we didn't recruit people generally into the lab. We recruited them around an idea. So, these were owned and operated ideas. I think the exception was Kai's idea for what eventually became Cash Play and Cash Play Games, where, he had the idea and it suited well with something we were thinking around in the online gambling space. But, and he was, he was an incredible leader for that business that we built inside Hatch. But for the most part, every idea we had conceived of initially, and we screened against that. We also screened, when we recruited talent, against that value system and that operating manifesto. And so at the time, during the duration of Hatch, I really felt people were collaborating and trying to help each other. If someone saw a colleague that wasn't doing his or her best or had opportunity for growth, I think they really stepped up and tried to help each other. And that's the culture we wanted to create. Now, sometimes cultures don't always transcend time. So, I'm not sure if all of those principles stayed, held true over the years, but certainly while we were at Hatch, we just tried to show an incredible amount of mutual respect for each other and live those values that were ingrained in why we started Hatch.
Yeah, and you just mentioned Kai, I mentioned Nina, Karthik, I mean, you look at Sean, everybody. And they're all titans in their own ways now. If you fast forward to today and everything and all the experiences that they learned while they were with you at Hatch, everyone talks about the PayPal mafia. You got this Hatch Labs mafia that has also gone around the world. You must be really proud of them.
I'm really proud of them. There's an incredible group of people that have gone off to start their own companies. I think Bo started privacy.com, and Kai's built other businesses and successfully exited them. He's a partner at a venture firm. There's a number of folks who've gone off to do incredible things. You know, I couldn't be more proud of the fact that, you know, Hatch Labs had a small part to play in shaping what the entrepreneurial journeys for these folks would be. The most important thing I hope that they remember is that sometimes, you know, the outcomes that happen are because of our hard work and our circumstances, and sometimes they're a little bit of luck. And you have to appreciate the luck and try to give back and help each other when you pursue all your next sort of wonderful endeavors in life, whether they're entrepreneurial or for the community. I'd love to see a little bit more caring and love in the world.
I love it. I speak a lot about it. I always talk about my network being my net worth. And it's not because I'm looking at it as a monetary thing. It's just keep putting good and trying to help everybody you meet and people around you. Just try to help them in a true way without looking for anything in return. And it always ends up coming back so much better. So much better. So if I'm in the position to actually help someone else in a particular situation, whether it be business or personal life, why don't I just take the time to go and do that to make things better for them? And, you know, I think Tony Hsieh, you know, used to talk a lot about this, where he talked about those collisions that happen, and you building out your network effect and how you could like just give without looking for anything else in return. And a lot ends up coming in a much bigger magnitude than if you even ever wanted to think about it in the beginning. I'm really resonating with what you say there. I wanted to switch gears though a little bit. We're in the middle of a pandemic, and it's going to be crazy if we don't talk about it. But what are some of your thoughts on how we've handled the situation up till now? And we're filming this on December 22nd, 2020. And what's your outlook? Well, how do you see us coming out of this?
Look, COVID's been a transformative experience for the earth. It's reminded us of our small place in a bigger ecosystem, that we can't always control, you know, our destinies. And that at the end of the day, despite all their differences between nations, between peoples, between even values and how we choose to live our lives or how we choose to run governments, that we're so interconnected. Because, you know, a tragedy in one place can affect another place. And so essentially what COVID's done through my lens is produce all these different experiments about how people have responded in different places. And if you look at how places like Taiwan and South Korea have responded compared to the US and other countries, there's such a stark contrast.
Just on that, Dinesh, what's with our leaders? I mean, we joke around always and we call R&D rip off and duplicate. There's a formula working in South Korea and in Taiwan. Why aren't we just implementing that?
Yeah, I think it stems from, and I'm not a political scientist or a sociologist, but maybe it was a little bit of a minor while I was a chemical engineer at Northwestern. But my view is that we are in the US and maybe North America, we're a very individualist society. We're not a collectivist society. Now, that brings its advantages. Entrepreneurship, our incredible freedoms, although I would argue that's not mutually exclusive from being a collectivist society. We focus on ourselves and achieving everything we can achieve, which has gotten us to where we are as a country. And it's been incredible. And I'm proud of it. But there's a fine line between individualism and prioritizing yourself over others. The reality is that many other countries have focused on coming together as a country and mutual sacrifice without viewing the things that are being politicized in this country, whether they're masks or whether they're certain behaviors or the existence of COVID-19, for example. They've come together in other countries to solve a problem, and here everyone's looking out for themselves on average. And I think we can change that. I think there's been a lot of love and warmth and kindness and support and help for healthcare workers and help for those in need. It's showed a lot of our humanity in pockets throughout this country. But I'd love to see more of that. And it's unfortunate that we can't come together and we let leaders that are more divisive separate us rather than sort of recognize that we share a lot more in common. So hopefully I think we can learn a little bit from these countries that have been successful, both in terms of the tools that they have to manage an epidemic and then now a pandemic, because they've faced in South Korea and in Taiwan epidemics before with SARS and other virulent epidemic crisis. But in the US, I think we have some of those same tools, but we haven't deployed them the same way. And it stems from our culture. And maybe it forces us to rethink who we are as a people, look in the mirror a little more closely and see how we can help each other instead of focusing on ourselves all the time.
Well said. I couldn't agree more. Where do you see it? How do you see us coming out of this? I know, the vaccines being rolled out. Focusing a little bit more on business, what do you think are going to be the habits or the transformational change that actually happens in society? I think a great example is my mom never used Amazon before, or even had groceries delivered to the house before, and now she's comfortable with it. She's actually even, getting meal prep kits sent to her, and she's all about the digital revolution that's happened. But that's one thing. But what do you see is going to become transformational change coming out of this pandemic?
I think there'll be a lot of transformation. It's already started. I think it's been an accelerant for things that were already on its way. In 2009, 10, 11, I wrote a piece in All Things D in the Wall Street Journal about mobile commerce and that it was coming. And it's been growing very fast over the last decade, year over year. So I think, our view was confirmed, but then you saw a step change in COVID where it not only got accelerated, but we became dependent on it. When there's a lockdown and you can't go outside, if you're, obeying the local ordinances, you have no choice but to do online ordering. So suddenly you have fundamental shifts in supply chains. You have changes in the number of boxes you need to be serving, spinning up in the cloud with Amazon Web Services or Google Cloud, et cetera, because these e-commerce companies are seeing so much demand. I'd say that the most interesting change for me personally, and then within the cohorts of folks that I talk to regularly, has been their travel. I was on the road almost every week. Even if it was a quick day trip, or if I might have spent 2 or 3 days in New York for a board meeting, I was typically flying out frequently. And Zoom has just fundamentally changed that. It's transcended geography and barriers. The idea of video conferencing as a really effective tool to be reliant upon for collaboration, for engaging. I've attended more conferences sitting in my home than I've ever attended actually flying to conferences. And I've given more talks than I ever did before. So
do you feel conferences will come back in a strong way though?
I don't know. I think that the most popular ones will, where the gravity of the connection, the human connection mm-hmm. of being near each other, especially when there are offline events, I'll give you an example. Fortune Brainstorm in Aspen is an event that I used to attend regularly. It's a very special event because of the destination, because of the experience, because of the informal fishing or hiking or biking. I think those yeah. things you just can't do on, in this sort of, paradigm. So I think those are going to come back. South by Southwest might come back. But, and I'm talking about tech events as one example.
Of course, there's a broad
number of events. But very content-focused, narrow, whether it's networking or it's interactions that produce content as a data exhaust to benefit an audience, I think those are probably going to stay on video conference because the cost of delivering that has dropped by an order of magnitude and the benefit is largely 90 to 100% of what it was before with respect to the content. So I think that there's some permanent changes that have happened here and some accelerants that are only going to continue. I think it's changed where people need to work. This is not true if you're dependent on a job where you're, maybe delivering food or groceries or driving for Uber. Maybe you're a plumber in your local community, vocational jobs, as well as other work that's tied to a physical location. Many workers in tech, which is kind of the world I live in, I just try to think beyond that as much as I can and get out of the bubble that sometimes we're trapped in. I think that they can effectively work anywhere. And you've seen that exodus out of the Bay Area, and talent has really been decentralized And COVID has served as a catalyst for making that happen. I think that's only going to continue because people realize that there are some great places to live outside of Silicon Valley. And most importantly, there are great communities and great people living elsewhere with politics, a financial trade-off, and a quality of life that can be dramatically better than being concentrated in one region.
I think that's so true. I mean, I'll tell you firsthand, I've spent 2 out of the last 3 months in Miami, and that exodus to Miami is real. You know, I think you see it on Twitter, people like, oh, nobody's like, okay, everybody's moving to Miami. No, it's real. I mean, every day I'd be on a patio or walking down the beach and meeting all new people who bluntly say, yeah, I just moved here. So it's definitely happening. And I know there's other cities like Austin or even here in the greater Toronto area, people just moving outside of the city being like, hey, I can now actually afford a home. Yeah. I don't have to be in the shoebox that I've been living in. And I can grow a family and do I can have the white picket fence and my job at the same time, which is also a bunch of things that we're going to check off on the personal career. But for myself and yourself, I think, you know, us not having to jump on airplanes every day and the beating we just took in going like airplane, airport to hotel, to conference, to meeting, to crappy food, to everything we had to do. It's been really good for me personally to just kind of inhale and be like, oh, I don't have to jump on a plane anytime soon. And it's kind of nice being grounded.
That's exactly right. So don't get me wrong. I miss my crisp white hotel sheets once in a while and my favorite restaurants in New York that I would be at every couple of weeks for work, or if I'm in San Francisco or I'm in another city. But the benefits, at least for workers that can function in a remote environment and have the flexibility of where they live, and they can be as productive, if not more productive, with the time that they get back from not being in an airport or being in a car, and they can just be focused on what they need to do, it's extraordinary. But I'd say the biggest silver lining is a reprioritization of the things that are important. That has hands down been, at least for my family, the most important thing in recognizing that I get a little more time with my kids, even though I'm working probably more hours in a day during COVID and in a remote environment. But just the time that I'm not spent commuting, I'm spending time with my daughter playing chess, or I'm showing my son how to play tennis, whatever it might be, these sort of benefits are immeasurable. And I think if people spend their time wisely, I might be busier 24 hours in a day now with the things I'm working on, but I'm getting a lot more time with my kids. And you can't put a price on that. And it couldn't have happened at a better time because my kids are young. And so for those that are listening, if they can use COVID, if they haven't already, as a reason to sort of look at themselves and reprioritize, I'd focus on the things that are important. You know, making money is important if you need to put food on the table. But the reality is, if you made enough, you can't take it with you when you die, right?
Right.
And so the things that matter when you get older, and you'll hear this repeatedly from people that are reaching a point in their life where they know the time is coming. It's the love and the relationships of the people that matter. That's what matters. And it's not just family, it's also friends. That's where you need to focus your time. Money is the byproduct of creating value. It's not the reason to create value. You first create value, you deliver value, then you harvest it. Harvest is really that byproduct of creating money. And I feel like in COVID, there are those that are suffering and they need to survive. And we should really be generous with how we try to help everyone during these difficult times, both as government and as people stepping beyond government to help one another. But for those who have enough, I think COVID's a good reminder to prioritize the things that matter. And I think family is a big one of those.
Absolutely. Well, very well said. I think, you know, you hit the nail on the head. Whenever someone is like about to pass away, they wish that the most regrets they have is, hey, I wish I was able to go to my kid's baseball game, or I wish I was able to go spend more time with my friends, and all these other things that when you're in the rat race, you just kind of forget. You're this hamster in a wheel and you keep spinning. And so this has given us a chance and to reevaluate what we can do in our lives to actually find the true meaning of happiness. Before we switch to Comcast Ventures, I just got one quick question for you. How do you feel big cities are going to respond? You know, New York, there's two sides. New York is never coming back. You've lived in New York before. You could never take away what New York is. You know, I'm here in Toronto, you're in LA. What do you think is going to happen to these big cities while we're seeing this, you know, suburban sprawl or even a migration just to other cities?
Yeah, it's a good question. So I think it depends on the city. I don't think we can apply a blanket to all of these cities. Toronto is so different than Madison, Wisconsin is different than Austin, that is different than Sarasota, Florida, for example. So maybe I'd start by saying that depending on where you live and the policies of that state and those cities, during COVID, the city and the community have come together, or they haven't. You know, I'm spending time in Los Angeles, and I can tell you that crime is up. Even though far fewer vehicles are on the road, the number of traffic accidents is extraordinary because people are driving like maniacs. There's lots of negative externalities I've observed in certain cities and communities, and in others I've seen quite the opposite during COVID. So I don't think the cities are going to respond necessarily all the same. I do think there's a decentralization of tech talent, but in terms of population centers, I think there's a shift away from population centers as long as it's accessible, you know, with a car ride away. Mm-hmm. And I think there is a sort of a reimagination of what the American dream is, at least in this country, and then that dream in all of the other countries about what people aspire to achieve and have in terms of quality of life. And I think that suburban dream in the US is alive and real, and it's the white picket fence you referred to, and it's a backyard for your kids, and it's kids being safe enough where, you know, you don't have to monitor them when they go outside, and they can just play with friends down the street. Like when I grew up, my parents didn't know where it was, and there were no cell phones. I'm sure it was the same for you, Sheetal.
Same thing.
And I played basketball at a friend's house, and I came back when it was dark, and that was the end of it. And they couldn't get a hold of me. They had the phone number for someone down the street or a few streets away, and they could track me down. We don't do that, or it doesn't feel like we do that in major cities anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, my kids are young, but I would never let them out even to the neighbor's house, who we know incredibly well, without sort of supervising the walk over. So we're tiger parenting too much, but it's a result of what we read and see in the news media and what we know is happening around us based on the information overflow we have. So I think that there's a view emerging, it's still emerging, that could we live in safe communities and safe neighborhoods outside of major cities, where there tends to be not necessarily the highest crime per capita, but on an absolute number basis, you know, more crime. And people are looking for the ability to work remotely if they can do that. And they're looking to have a higher quality of life given their income levels and the communities that they want to live in. I think it's fundamentally going to change urban development. It's going to change all the corresponding enabling conditions for that to happen, how housing is developed, energy resource system management, you know, potentially transmission of energy and reliance on renewables. It's going to change our focus on what sustainable living means. It's going to change what transportation looks like. Suddenly, it's possible there's more demand for things like Hyperloop technologies in areas where you wouldn't have had urban density. Maybe you have suburban density. So it's going to change a lot of different things. I think it's far too early. We're in the first inning of a ninth inning journey, and I don't know what that's going to look like. But I think we should just be prepared for lots of change.
You know, even pre-pandemic, I spent a lot of time in Dubai in the past 4 years, and everything in Dubai is essentially like, hey, live here, work here, play here, shop there, and it's all in a walking distance of a little community. And then they just build the cookie cutter, these in various architecture, but the cookie cutter of these communities all over the place. And, you know, we, especially in Toronto or even New York, you're starting to see more and more of that start to happen. And now with COVID and people moving out, it's you know, I'm wondering what's gonna end up happening and how that's gonna end up transforming these cities. But I did want to get to you, and I think this is a great segue, by the way, I did want to get to you and how you are investing in sustainable technologies. What are you looking at personally? How is Dinesh looking at what he wants to invest in and the change he wants to see happen with your investment dollars and more your help and network as well?
Well, historically, in the past few years, I've really been focused on trying to find sustainability investments. So we've made a number of those investments, from last mile transportation investments that are eco-friendly, to investing in autonomous vehicles technology companies, one of which you know about, with our friends that sold their business to Ford, and even businesses like Zoox, which recently revealed their vehicle. We sold that to Amazon this year. And so really focusing on whether it's energy or transportation or other big areas that release large volumes of heat trapping gases. I think in the EPA, according to, I think it was 2018, about 28.2% of all transportation exhaust is the contributing percentage of heat trapping gases on Earth. So almost a third. And that's transportation alone. Then we get into agriculture and we get into industrials and other areas. So we need to address this. We have, our fund has an investment in Dandelion Energy, which replaces fossil fuels such as heating oil and natural gas with geothermal energy for homes in the Northeast. You know, these are clever ways of using sustainable technologies that already exist, frankly. They just have to become cost efficient and scalable to begin replacing our reliance on fossil fuels and increasing our dependence on renewables. But it's not so straightforward, because intermittency challenges with renewables and seasonality, which is related to intermittency, means that renewable production from wind, solar, and hydro is not necessarily consistent and uniform. So we're always going to have, at least in the near future, some dependence on fossil fuels. We really need investment in R&D and technology to help address some of this. And there needs to be a lot more research, not just on the technology, but also research on the economic incentives and the opportunities to shape policy and the decision-making happening at large companies about their own sustainability initiatives. And so if we can bring the science and economics together in a way to advance some of the work being done to either drastically reduce our dependence on fossil fuels, or maybe even begin geoengineering the Earth to address heat trapping gases, I think we have a path to seeing light at the end of this tunnel.
And do you feel that the focus is going more into this area? Is there enough dollars flowing into this area? I mean, again, we don't want to get too political, but the last 4 years in the U.S., this is, I mean, the mantra of the president was the opposite way. And the U.S. is obviously just one player, because now you're talking about a global advancement that you would like to see happen and can happen. So from a global let's take it from a global standpoint, are you seeing the investments in R&D? Are you seeing the investments from the business community and what they need to do to make this happen? Go and move the dial in a way of like, hey, it's actually going to move the dial and we'll be into where Dinesh thinks we should be in 5 years, or do you need to see way more for that to happen? Let me use your words. How do we draw a point and then bend the paper on this?
Yeah, to bend space on this, I think it's two things. I think it's one, reduction of our ongoing reduction of dependence on fossil fuels. And if you peel that back one layer, it is R&D and investment in technology, both through governments and subsidies potentially. Again, I think there's more research needed there, as well as the private sector. The other big area is coming up with artificial solutions. So for example, even if we brought our carbon emissions down to zero or heat trapping gas emissions down to zero today, there's a huge timescale lag effect with how long it would take to actually improve the situation, because we've been industrializing the world for the last couple hundred years. And we're now seeing the effects of that, even though it's been exacerbated recently. And so we may need some sort of artificial intervention in using science to geoengineer a solution to prevent heat trapping gases from continuing to melt the Arctic and cause the other destruction that are the second and third order consequences of some of the things that are happening. So I think a lot more research is needed. I think universities need government funding for more research in all the areas, not just the science and engineering and the economics. There are a lot of areas, there are sociological considerations and others. But what I'd say is that we're not probably moving fast enough, but I've been delighted to see the private sector do as much as they have been. Look back 10 years ago at the price of photovoltaic cells, And you'll see that these photovoltaic modules were, priced at X, and everyone thought there was sort of a declining rate of pricing, but it was, not following anything like Moore's law. Mm-hmm. The reality is photovoltaic modules for capturing solar radiation and turning that into energy and storing it. I mean, that technology on photovoltaics has dramatically dropped in price, dramatically far in excess of what I think anyone had anticipated, at least based on the research I've read. And so that's a huge boon for the solar industry, and using solar as a potentially reliable source of capturing virtually free energy. The key is storage and transmission. And when I talked about the intermittency problem, if you end up with a big cloud cluster that's blocking solar radiation area, and that area was, let's say, hypothetically 100% dependent on solar radiation, and these photovoltaic modules capturing all of this, ultimately, suddenly power would be out. Right, and right. Have to rely on another grid. And if there'd be a peak in that grid to overcome this local minimum where there's an energy drop, suddenly you're in a situation where that second power plant that maybe you had some relationship with or some transmission provisioning has suddenly hit peak capacity, and now they're facing a brownout situation. So there's all sorts of cascading effects here, second and third order effects. And ultimately, I think a lot more research is needed to understand how best to design these systems for an effective civil society, urban infrastructure, rural infrastructure, storage and transmission to be able to fully utilize the benefits of renewables, which we have. And I think the technology has really improved. And I'm pretty proud of the private sector of what they've done. But I think the level of funding needs to dramatically increase, and the level of innovation in deploying those technologies in a way that's good for the earth, as opposed to just good for pocketbooks, is really important.
I love how you said it. I think, we're going to get to a point now where it's probably going to be good for your pocketbook and good for the earth if we play our cards right. Dinesh, I know we've come up to the top of the hour. I want to thank you so much for joining us. You've dropped some serious knowledge bombs I've been lucky enough to get to know you over the years, and I was learning a lot during this episode. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
For sure. You could see First Name Basis. You can see us on YouTube, but you can listen to First Name Basis on Apple Podcasts, Spotify. And it also gets posted to our Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, everywhere. Dinesh, thanks so much again for joining us.
Thank you.